wondrous.
Siren 107.3.
Visit us at sirenonline.co.uk.
We like to hear that as well, which is all great stuff. Anna Lewis in Jersey, how are you?
Oh, fine, thank you. Just bearing up with Christmas round the corner. It's scary. It's too close.
You say bearing up, Anna, but you know, fundamentally it's that time of the year where we all sort of feel we're bearing up. I'm not sure whether back in the day you ever did a show in Dulwich with Graham Harper. You were around sort of contemporaries in all sorts of ways, or guest director then of Doctor Who, now Inside Number 9. But Graham, now you can honestly say you're connected via Lincoln to Jersey. That's actually just between France and England, in case you're looking for the whole system. Yeah, I know. Strange, but there we go.
I have such nice memories of Jersey. It's such a lovely place.
Listen, before we move any further, Anna, we need to point out this is the man who directed Bergerac, many episodes of Bergerac with John Nettles. I mean,
brilliant.
Bergerac without Jersey. Well, Tessa, you're probably too young to remember Bergerac.
I've heard of it. I bet you mum and dad.
Leanie James is here now. She'd say Bergerac. Tessa, I brought you up on Bergerac.
She might, yeah, that is exactly what
you've forgotten
she'd
it. Oh, with John Nettles in the lead role and Terence Alexander and all those fine folk there. Shirley McKenzie, you're also going to say Bergerac. I'm sorry, I was born in South Africa.
Exactly, and I'm also just in awe that Graham Harper is on the line.
You see,
because I love Inside Number 9.
Shaley McKenzie loves Inside Number 9.
I spread it like a virus and make sure all my friends watch it because it is incredible.
It's not great to
It's hear. A nice odd series, isn't it? Yeah, I think you're right. Oh. Great stories. Interesting.
Stories, students. Are you actually involved with any of the ones that are going out over the festive season, Graham?
And not the ones that are going out. I've done two in the series, this next season of theirs, but they're not going out over the Christmas period. They're going to go out, I think, later in January.
Right. So there we are. It's something to look forward to then, Shayla.
I'm excited.
Do we get any spoilers, any sort of, or any sort of sneak previews in terms of what the focus is? Because I'm still recovering from your Crossroads-esque delve into horror for the one from last Christmas.
I don't think I should give anything really away, but I won't give anything away. They're really, really interesting.
He was going
and
then he decided not to.
He suddenly felt the spectre of Reese Shearsmith.
That's how he gets us, Alex.
Exactly. It's just
weird. We don't know the half of it.
I know. It's a strange sort of system. So, Anna, you remember Bergerac, of course, do you not?
I do. We have John Nettles in our library quite a lot, actually, because he researches the German occupation. That's his latest kind of interest, and he's produced videos and all sorts of material. He's linking up with Germany as well, which is quite a brave move to look at the role of the Germans in the Channel Islands. So he's a very thorough researcher, I have to say. Not just a very handsome man, of course, but he's very interested in history. And his daughter lives in the island, which is really why he comes over quite regularly now.
I did I only directed two episodes of Bergerac, but one of them was about a German war film being made on the island at that particular time, about a story that happened in 50 years before or whatever. And I know it interested John, the whole thing, the whole aspect of this story. It was quite a grim story, and through that we learnt a lot about the history of Jersey.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting location. It's a bit like Midsummer Murders. You've got a very limited location range in terms of Midsummer. And in the same way, Bergerac set in Jersey, the creativeness of the directors showing you around the island where you go through a tunnel and you end up like 3 miles in the wrong direction. It's brilliant, really. It's fun if you're a local to go back and look at these things. It really is.
One day, Anna, we will have that Midweek Drive outside the broadcast location coming from Jersey, despite the fact that you just regularly want to get away from the island. It's okay. We will be coming to you.
You want to
again.
Get away?
Yeah, I know, Graham.
It's called Island Fever, as I discovered the other day. I stayed at an Airbnb, and the lady said to me, "You know what you're suffering from, Anna? You're suffering from island fever." And it's starting to make sense. It really is. It's being hemmed in an island that's 45 square miles. It really, it doesn't do your sort of soul much good.
Anna, look, you feel as though you're hemmed in 45 square miles. How do you think Gabriella Peralta feels? She's only got 3 miles in Gibraltar.
You know. Oh, gosh, that's scary.
It's amazing on a Thursday morning she can even... I mean, if it wasn't for Frodo, the semi-conscious pug, who knows what her life would be. Still, never mind. Moving on, because I think we've exhausted the sort of Jersey thing for the moment, and we've got the Saturnalia Paradox, we've got the UK-USA Holiday Nexus, but we've also got another reveal, another play for what last week, Graham, was voted the number one midweek drive festive tune.
Nice.
In terms of there were three entrants into the whole sort of system, and Rosie Nimmer was the winner. So it really is time for yourself. It's a bit like the Christmas edition of Strictly, really, in many ways, where it's not really competitive, but it's a fun thing to actually work through. So Graham and Anna, are you happy to stay with us as we have this little reprise? And indeed, fans of Sound and Country Vision will have another reprise between 7 and 8 this very evening.
Get another chance to hear it.
Tessa Snott is going to be doing a live version of Sound and Country Vision in this very studio between 7 and 8.
Oh. First ever live one, I think.
Without the aid of a safety net, well, it's volume 15?
16.
Volume 16.
Yeah,
16 glorious episodes. Wow. Tessa, would you like to, for the benefit of Graham and for Anna and for our listener, we love you, really, stay with us, it's Siren Radio. Would you like to actually announce the next tune, please? The winner, of course, of the Midweek Drive.
Yes, so it's Rosie Nimmo with A Child in the Snow.
Slipping and sliding in the snow, and you know it won't last. Soon it will go. Laughing out loud, it's a snowball fight. You're a big kid again, sure feels right. Dog chases snowballs, it's vanishing cold air. Laugh and you love it, don't have a care. You relish the prospect, no work for a week, as you play in the snow till you can't feel your feet. Or stay cozy and toasty in front of the fire. You can doze, you can daydream, sleepy as time. You know that soon all the snow will be gone. You'll have to put your sensible hat back on. Make important decisions and keep your face straight. Home in the dark after leaving the house before 8. But for now you can slip, you can slide in the snow. Play like a child, like there's nowhere to go. Cherish the moment, for soon it will go. Feel like a child again in the snow. Feel like a child again in the snow. Being a child, being a child in the snow. In the snow, I feel like a child again. In the snow, I feel like a child in the snow.
So, director extraordinaire Graham Harper, what do you make of Rosie Nimmo? No relation to Derek. Again, probably before the time of Anna and indeed Tessa and indeed Shaylee. Derek Nimmo, of course. Oh, brother, oh, father. What did you make of Being a Child in the Snow?
I liked it very much. It reminded me of Big Yellow Taxi.
Yeah.
It's a really, really nice chip. It's really typical of a light-hearted French film. You could hear that tune in the background of that.
I got a slight sense of Amelie possibly coming across there, a nice touch there, very good. And Anna, is you're closer to France than any of us in the studio at present, even Graham Harper, although technically being married to Bernadette, who is French, you could say there's a little bit of France always in Acton. What were your thoughts?
It's beautiful. She's got a lovely little voice. It's got a little trill, and it's really pure. It sounds so lovely. It should be, you know, she should go out there and do more with it, because it sounds beautiful. Yeah, I love it.
Well, there we are, you see. That's probably one of the reasons why she was a winner on the Madrid Drive. Her career can only go one way now. I would say no more. It's a way forward. So, Anna, what do you have in store for Jerseyites, and what do Jersey people do over the festive season? Or is it just a case of, well, we actually give thanks for world peace and happiness and that the Germans have gone?
Yes, well, the Germans have definitely gone, but we've got a problem with a seagull. That's made front page news today, and he's gone viral.
He's
a seagull who's been called Gulliver, and he photobombs people getting married on the beach. He's brutal, and he apparently was a hand-reared bird, and the first media report, and sorry media studies people who are doing journalism, but reporting is critical, that it was reported that he should be shot, and there was like uproar in the community, and people all over the world said, you can't shoot Gulliver, it's not his fault, he's been hand-reared, and it's a silly bird, and aggravates dogs and couples who are getting married, and steals people's hats.
So I'd Gulliver like to say that this is probably a celebrity. Like it's probably he's got something against marriage, and he's telling the people not to get married.
Yeah, it's probably a real statement against life in general, but they're actually deporting him to a little area of rocks called the Minkies. They've decided he's too much of a threat on the beach to children and dogs. So they've managed to catch him, and he's now being shipped off the island.
We have a University of Lincoln connection here with one of our great live series folk, because a dive bombing seagull attacking beachgoers in Jersey could be killed by the island's government after a number of complaints. But a move to save the hand-reared seabird known as Gulliver, obviously Anna always gives us the facts, has the backing of wildlife presenter and Lincoln Great Lives presenter Chris Packham. If Chris can't actually use the University of Lincoln magic to save Gulliver, frankly, that's just we might as well cancel Christmas now.
But when this bird ends up in the Minkies, won't it just fly back?
Well, that's what everyone has said the same thing. He's not going to stay there, of course. He's got wings, for God's sake. So we reckon he will fly back and cause more aggro and trouble, but he's normally just perched in one beach doing this. He doesn't go around the island doing it. He's not on location.
Gulliver, effectively, in securing the support of Chris Packham, clearly they're both on social media, it's the way for all seagulls to go these days, Chris Packham, tweeted Jersey's government to say the bird isn't dangerous and should be saved.
I agree.
This really reminds me of first, second year learning shorthand. We had a passage about seagulls attacking and how they were taking over, and it's just come to life.
Apparently, more than 20 complaints about the dive bombing girl have actually sort of been made, harassing beachgoers. But indeed, as you said, Anna, more than 700 people have signed an online petition to save the friendly seagull.
I think so. It makes the weddings unique.
It does. Photographs are amazing.
They are really good.
They are lovely. Yeah.
We're just having a look through some now, and they're captured really well.
Shaylee, your thoughts on this? I mean, would you bring out the bazooka, or what effectively sort of say, no, it's like Jonathan Livingston's seagull. He was good.
I'd try feeding it. I'd be like, come here, little seagull.
I'd encourage.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely think, as he's called Gulliver, he's obviously satirising marriage, and he's got something to say about people getting married on that particular beach.
Isn't there a film, Gulliver's Island or Gulliver's Travels?
There is a book, actually. A very famous book, Georgian literature, so a bit before various other things, done as a satire, done by Jonathan Swift.
He is travelling.
And, of course, there's always the legendary Jonathan Livingston Seagull, written by Richard Bach, which is the whole range of things there. So it's Jonathan Gulliver. Well, there we are, Graham. That's the subject of your next movie, Gulliver the Seagull. I think we can actually sort of get it put together probably before you actually get the Romanian gig sorted out. So it'll be fine. Yeah. Sign up the rights now, and we know that you'll make a good job of that. And, Graham, are you staying in this country, or are you going back to France over the weekend? In which case...
No, We're going to stay here.
You're going to stay here. It's nice to hear. Because normally he's always off to France, effectively.
I'd just stay in France.
Yeah. Really?
What's it like there? I bet it's beautiful over Christmas. All the lights.
Where we go is a town called Sète, which is in the southwest of France, and near Montpellier. And at Christmas, one particular year, we actually sat on a veranda in T-shirts having Christmas lunch. Mm. I couldn't believe it, because I thought France would be colder than that.
Is it Australia? It's easily confused.
Who knows, yeah.
I mean, the only difference in many ways is presumably greater striped shirts and onion rings in France, whereas greater kind of didgeridoos in Australia, he says, making cultural crass references, which I don't know.
And the time it takes to get to each place.
Do you think so?
Big difference.
Well, Graham has directed in Australia as well, of course. See How They Run, children's TV series of the late 90s. Very good as well. Let's move on.
I loved Australia. Sorry.
Who doesn't, really? Who doesn't love Australia, apart from when they're playing cricket? But let's not go there, because it is the festive edition of the Midweek Drive on Siren Radio. And I know, Graham, you'd like to put those last two questions to Anna Lewis. Please, away you go, please. So off you go.
It's been very nice talking to you, Anna. Would you like us to call you again?
I would, but next week I'm on holiday.
So are we. It's all right. Boxing Day, no midweek drive. If you want the midweek drive on Boxing Day, go to the website, download the podcasts, listen again. You've got over 3,000, so keep you busy.
Well, have a really happy Christmas, folks. So, for the next few weeks. Couple of weeks now, isn't it?
We will see you in 2018.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's
brilliant.
The idea. Anna will return. We set a round of applause for Anna.
Yay!
One of Jersey's finest in so many ways. Now, Graham, if you're kind enough to stay with us now, we're going to have a little bit of a break, because we've done a pre-record from this point of view with an Owen Paul. Owen Paul, who was a singer when we actually started doing radio programmes back in the 1980s. I know, it's difficult to believe, but there you are. And we're going to find out what he's been getting up to over the next few moments, etc. Are you okay there? Are you sitting comfortably? Is everything okay in the joys of Acton, where you're currently based?
Excellent. Really happy.
This is marvellous stuff. Oh, well, to take us around to this, a whole heap of other goodies as well. We've also got Merle Fankhauser, who's an American singer, songwriter and broadcaster, and Mike Salisbury. Now, Graham, you might think, Mike Salisbury, what's he done then? Well, Michael Jackson's White Glove, that was his idea. Single White Glove, I'll have to say. Single White Glove. So lots of good news still to come as far as that's concerned. Meanwhile, with his favourite waste of time, here's Owen.
You're mine. You're the one.
Well, it's finally happened. We've promised you this for weeks. We've had the excitement of saying it is going to happen one of these days. We don't give up, never give up, never surrender. We have got the awesome legend that is Owen Paul with us. Owen, finally, good to welcome you to the Midweek Drive on Siren Radio. How are you?
I'm very well, Alex. Thank you very much, and thank you for persevering. I don't know what's going on with the phone lines and all sorts, but we got there.
Well, we were trying tapping the table and telepathy, but neither of those techniques were really working well for radio, we found. So, you know, just...
Yeah, this is true.
Step away from the whole thing. Looking back at that wonderful decade, the 80s, my favourite waste of time is one of those, I can only describe it as iconic songs that really kind of set so many people sort of going and tapping in all sorts of ways, etc.
Sure.
We look back now, and I know there's always that tendency to look back with nostalgia and stagger backwards into the future, looking longingly into the past. But there was a sort of sense there that it was a simpler time. I know that we had challenges, you know, we had a Thatcher government, we had all sorts of other areas within the globe, etc. Maradona had actually robbed England of a World Cup place.
I remember it well. even for a Scotsman, I was gutted.
I know, exactly. And Scotland were experiencing the last time they would be in the World Cup finals for some time. No, I won't go there. I know. Inappropriate. Let's move on with this. So, share with us what led you into the music business in the first place. What was the thing that actually said, yeah, it's time to actually start carving a slice open of this thing we call popular culture?
Yeah, well, for me, it actually happened the decade before that, in the sort of mid-70s, around 75, 76. I'd been, as a teenager anyway, looking like I was going to be a professional football player, which was no bad thing in itself, and I was signed to my dream team as such, being a Glasgow boy, to Glasgow Celtic, and that was the way it was looking. And then all of a sudden, the punk explosion happened in 75 and 76 with the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the Damned and bands like that. And I remember hearing Anarchy in the UK and thinking, because I was already a music fan, I listened to Bowie and some prog rock stuff like Yes or ELP and weird bands like that and stuff, and I liked, you know, that kind of music as such. But I'd never heard anything like Anarchy in the UK in my life. And I remember it affecting me in a weird way, not like, well, that's just a nice song or that's just a good noise as such. I felt something else. And I'm sure it was the same for everyone around that decade, in the middle anyway. And like I was saying, what happened in a weird kind of way, it became a massive culture movement, the punk thing. And everybody formed bands like virtually overnight. Instead of going to youth clubs, they go, let's get a band, even though you couldn't play. Now, this was like, you know, the green light to me, because I couldn't play an instrument or anything. And off the back of that, my brother and his school friends, they formed the Simple Minds, believe it or not. And I used to listen to them rehearse. I was 15 at the time, and they were like maybe 2 years older. So I was always in the background just talking about listening to them.
You were looking for the glittering prizes. You didn't want to be forgotten about by them, and you wanted to go on the waterfront. Sorry, I couldn't resist it.
No, please. Anyway, this is way before that time and that massive success. This is the early, early days for them. But you could tell that they had something right away, which is, you know, obviously proved in the decade following that. But for me, I used to listen to them rehearse, hear them doing the working thing, and then, as I said, because I'd end up in a band myself, I got to the difference between, say, being a professional football player and working in the music business is that I loved the boring parts of the music business, so working in studios and rehearsing for days on end trying to get something right, whereas in football, I absolutely hated the training. So it was a very easy decision for me. Once I realised that it became quite natural to me and I didn't have any musical qualifications, but I could very quickly pick a thing up and learn an instrument. I mean, I remember I learned to play the piano in about 10 hours and I had no idea what I was doing, but there was some kind of something going on. And before I knew it, that was me sort of mid to late 70s, much that it took me another 8 or 9 years before anyone knew of me. I was working, you know, doing the punk scene, playing at the 100 Club in London and all the punky clubs that are popping up all over the country. I should have been at school most of the time, so that was another issue. But I got away with it. And it wasn't until sort of, you know, the changing of the decade when, because I was, although I much believed in the ethos and the feeling of the punk it wasn't my music as such, so I was much more melodic than that. So I was a bit of a square peg in a round hole in that regard. It wasn't until the New Romantic thing came along that I felt much more comfortable. And at the back end of that, I got my record deal, you know, and away we went.
It's interesting, the kind of classic overnight success that's been working at it for a decade.
Well, that's absolutely right, because when I became known, you know, in the middle of 1986, I think the song Favourite Waste of Time was released on my birthday, May the 1st, that year. As you said, I'd already released a couple of records prior to that. Plus, I'd been in the music industry as a 15-year-old. I'm now 24 in 1986. And as you said, most of the time when it was reported, overnight sensation, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was like, not quite. You know, it's a bit like anything else. It's like doing, you know, learning a trade. And if you're a carpenter or a builder, you have to put the study in. So I have no regrets about that.
And that's a really interesting point, because certainly, I mean, we heard, obviously, My Favourite Waste of Time at the top of the piece here. And I think in terms of carving your trade, I mean, you say you were self-taught for that, but that experience of a decade of actually practicing, dealing with audiences that may have been appreciative, yeah, or maybe less appreciative, we don't know. I mean, obviously, back in the days of punk, it was perhaps a win if you actually got some chopped liver thrown at you in the on the thing. I mean, who knows what could happen?
That and the rest.
Well, yeah, that's,
you're absolutely correct. But I did learn my trade that way, and you know, and I put in the hours. So by the time it came to being a success and getting played on national radio or television and stuff, I was more than ready.
Yep. Now, let's spool forward a little bit now, because again, people were saying, yeah, Owen Paul, same Rick Astley, the various, all, I sort of think, put me in the same bracket, ridiculous, I'm far superior, quite rightly so. But in terms of a whole range of artists that we're developing then, we look back now with, as I say, a certain amount of nostalgia. Great news is, you're back, and quite literally, it's amazing.
There you go.
You see what we did there? We're going to take a short musical break now. If that's okay, Owen, I'd like you to introduce this Stonebridge and Damien Hall radio edit of Amazing, and we'll talk a bit more about how this came about and why it's been ridiculous amount of time. We know, where's Owen Paul been? We need you, Owen. You're back with us. The Scottish National Football Team needs you. Even, I'd have to say, Brendan Rodgers probably needs you to sort out the European campaign.
Oh, well, don't even go there about the European campaign. Anyway, here it comes. Owen Paul is back after 31 years, and it's even already in the UK dance club charts, and it's amazing, Stonebridge and Damien Hall remix.
energetic, innovative. It's as though you've never been away. Yay! Owen Paul is back. Whoa! As you can hear, the spirit of Siren Radio, they're going crazy, Owen. Finally, relief. After all these years, Owen's back, and it is amazing. And genuinely, actually, when we first heard that, I mean, we have played it a couple of times beforehand, and the response has been highly positive. Great that we managed to connect with the good stuff. I know some of the Midweek Drive acts who normally are with us on the programme, they're gutted that they couldn't actually connect with the good stuff. But it's fine. So, without going into the details, etc., I mean, I know you can't hurry genius, but Why such a gap? I mean, you know, there's so much to actually get to that sort of stage. Is it just a case of those immortal words, darn those record companies and their darn legal aspects?
It was very much that. I mean, I know it's a cliche, and there's lots of cases that happened before me and after, and it's almost like the norm in the industry as such. Basically, what happened when I made Favourite Waste of Time, obviously being such a pop hit worldwide, the record company naturally wanted more of the same. Unfortunately, I was signed to them as a rock act, and I did not want more of the same. Yeah, I wanted the flexibility to come and go, make rock records, make pop records,
sure.
Like even now, like making a dance record, but they were not keen on that. And off the back of the fact, obviously, as well, that I became a pin-up and was in smash hits magazines and the front cover of this and calendars and all sorts, they more so wanted me to stay in the pop game. And when I wouldn't do that, they were refusing to promote any of the stuff that I wanted to do. So it was an obvious route that we're going to end up either in court or I was going to have to walk away on, you know, go on a mini protest as such, which is what I did. I just didn't realise when I walked away it was going to take me 20 years to walk back.
Well, the fact of the matter is you're true to yourself and it's working through it. I mean, it's interesting that surely it's very short-sighted on behalf of the radio industry that actually versatility and having artists, I mean, for goodness sakes, let's scroll back another 20 years. People didn't actually complain when the Beatles switched from actually being mop-top, foursome to actually producing Sgt. Pepper and Rubber Soul and various other bits and pieces. The whole point is, you know, you should have the flexibility to change to find your right scenario. I mean, the late, great David Cassidy had to shift again in terms of his own sort of lines, etc. So, oftentimes you tend to think, look, we appreciate agencies, we appreciate managements, and so on, but sometimes you think, look, you can't just replace more of the same. Sometimes you've got to open up a bit. Anyway,
I certainly believe in that. And the artist that I'd like, somebody like David Bowie, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he still worked and even made some extremely experimental albums. Even his biggest album, Heroes, has got a multitude of just instrumental tracks on there.
At a time when
he's in the mainstream. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the day, Owen, when you actually cover V2 Schneider from the Heroes album. Yeah,
that's actually if you play Amazing, it's kind of a little bit like it.
Now, yeah, well, it's a thought. Oh, V2 Schneider.
V2 Schneider.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Can people actually get hold of Amazing now? Can they get it through all the usual sort of online service lines, etc.?
Yes, indeed, they can.
And have you got a website that we can connect as well, and social media and so on? How can people stay in touch with the awesomeness that is Owen Paul?
I will tell you everything right now in one go, I hope. Yes, indeed, you can get the Amazing. It's available right now to buy iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and the rest, even Spotify, which I detest, but hey-ho, you know, we are doomed if we do, doomed if we don't. And yes, you can get it from theowenpaul.com. You can also get it via Twitter, which is Owen Paul Real, or you can get it at my Facebook page, which is Facebook Owen Paul Official Page.
Brilliant. Owen, it's been an absolute delight sharing some moments with you. I'm going to put this up as a special podcast as well because it's really been a pleasure. Finally getting to shoot the breeze with your good self. We know Jeremy was working hard. We knew we'd get together and we have. We put our trust in the airways and it has worked through. I've got two final critical questions to ask you though.
Yeah.
Actually, three really. I could actually talk about Celtic, but we won't go there. As a Manchester City fan, you'll appreciate I'm still sort of savouring the Pep Guardiola time. And actually, you did have one of our players actually. Have one of our players on loan, so it's all good.
As we had him on loan, he did very well.
Yes, exactly. So good.
We don't want to give him back.
He even actually scored against us in the 3-3 draw that kind of did for us sort of last season. I won't go there. It's a different line.
Yes.
Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today, Owen Paul? Has it been good for you?
as I was about to say when you were talking about, you know, regardless of whether technology doesn't always work on making records, we finally got there. It's a team game. Life is a team game. I'm absolutely delighted that we finally got there.
So the next critical question is, can we in 2018 hopefully look to connect with you again and speak more about your experiences in the music industry and more? Will you be kind enough to return to the airwaves with us?
I absolutely guarantee it. I'd love to.
I know, you didn't think he'd end either, but he did. And it's Patrick Roberts, in case you're wondering who the player was who joined Celtic for a loan period from Man City. But as an Arsenal supporter, Graham, you would have thought, what? I mean, is it ever going to stop? Please, I had enough of the 80s being there, for goodness sakes.
I agree, actually. I thought the 80s was pretty... musically wasn't great, wasn't the greatest period, with some exceptions.
Exactly, exactly. Anyway, that was Owen Paul proving he's not dead. Moving on. Well, you know, sometimes I feel we actually sort of have to have that segment of the Midweek Drive. We have Chilpack Hollywood, who effectively have the celebrity deaths and tributes from that point of view. I feel we can actually say we can have a little segment saying, I'm not dead yet, you know, which is all good.
I say that every day.
Exactly. That's a definite line from a sort of point of view. It's another day in which our mission on the planet is still going strong. Much as Merrill Fankhauser is, because Merrill is an American singer, songwriter and guitarist, most active in the 1960s and 70s with bands including The Impacts, Merrill and the Exiles, HMS Bounty and indeed the Fankhauser Cassidy Band. And all being well, we're going to be linking up with Merrill in a few moments. Graham, are you ready for that?
I'm waiting.
Shaylee McKenzie, are you ready for Merrill Fankhauser, who is male, not female, as you originally thought, no relation to Meryl Streep?
What a shame.
Well, it's a thought. We'll find out. Of course, he actually sort of has been based in Lancaster, California, as opposed to England. So it's interesting. Tessa, are you ready for Merrill Fankhauser?
I am indeed.
Here's Fabadockley with Merrill Fankhauser and Lila.
She
Harper, Ace director. What did you make of Lila?
This is real 60s. We're right back in the 60s. We're on a surfing beach and we're having a great time.
It is real 60s. That's why we welcome the awesome Merrill Fankhauser to the program. Merrill, welcome aboard the Madrid Drive. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very good here in California. Thank you, Alex, for having me on your show.
Hey, anybody who gets the recommendation from Mr. Saunders is clearly an okay soul, and as I say, it's great to connect with your good self. And whereabouts in California are you? Hopefully not by the fires.
No, I'm about 80 miles north of the fire, but we're still getting a good deal of smoke here. And for about 3 days, it was like living in a science fiction movie because it was as though somebody had put a colored lens, you know, over the camera. Everything looked orange, and the sun was just a dot in the sky. It was, I'd never seen it like that, and they were recommending people wear masks and don't go outside unless you absolutely have to. So the prevailing winds had blown it up the coast north, and I'm on the coast.
I mean, Merle, do they not realize with all that smoke it's going to be dangerous for Rudolph and his red-nosed reindeer? I mean, for goodness sake.
I know, and how are they going to navigate?
Oh, I mean, we already talked about the seagull in Jersey. What about the reindeer traveling over the... let's move to your biography, Merle. Basically, Merle Fankhauser led one of the most diverse and interesting careers in music. Born in Louisville, Kentucky, moved to California when you were 13 years of age, went on to become one of the innovators of surf music and psychedelic folk rock.
There you are.
So, I'm thinking, we have a BAFTA award-winning director in Acton, London, actually connecting with us. So that's the voice of Graham. I'll do the introductions for you, Merrill, to work through that. We've got, in the studio here in Lincoln, England, Merrill, we have Shaylee McKenzie.
Hello.
And Tessa Snart.
Hi.
Great.
Hi.
In Acton, in London, England... Always like to give that little bio ever since the days of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. where they'd actually say, Manchester, England. And it always looked like Southern California. It's crazy. We have BAFTA award-winning director Graham Harper.
Hello, Merrill. Nice to talk to you.
So, Graham, would you like to take over the questioning mantle to start off with before we hear more of Merrill's fabulous tunes? I mean, because you are actually one of the folk who can remember the 60s because it was... one of the times where you had just gone out of doing Miss Master Bardell as a child actor and you were just starting off your whole sort of entertainment professional work.
Well, the thing about that period was I joined the BBC as a runner, and I was working on lots of different programmes, and one of them was called Top of the Pops. And I was always aware during the making of the Top of the Pops, which is a pop show, pop music, I was very aware of the competition between all the bands and the similar styles of music that they played. And I often wondered, and I'm sure you'll tell us, Merle, was it exciting, a really exciting period of competitiveness between you all? Or did you all go, were you all so laid back, and was it all so very cool that you didn't really care about what other people were doing? It seems so frenetic.
Well, when I started, Graham, I was living on this little coastal town here of Arroyo Grande near Pismo Beach that was famous for the clams. And I was about 17 years old, and a bunch of my high school mates and I formed a band called The Impacts. And we eventually got the house band job at the biggest auditorium on the Central Coast, the Rose Garden Ballroom. And at that time, in 1962, it was the biggest ballroom between Los Angeles and San Francisco. And I was a surfer, and so I would be surfing, and I would come up with these surfing titles, and I'd write these instrumentals to these titles. And I was very into groups like the Champs and the Ventures, and I got to meet the Ventures, and they were kind of my heroes. So we were discovered there by Delphi Records, and they took us to Los Angeles, and we recorded our Wipeout album by the Impacts that was on Delphi, the label that had Richie Valens, and they started signing a lot of other surf bands. So we didn't think about any competition at that point. We were just, I was just writing these songs and, you know, coming up with them and working on the arrangements with the bands. And then all of a sudden, all over California, it was as if somebody sprinkled magic dust up the whole coast. Every band that you could think of, every teenage band, started playing instrumentals. And so that was the big thing. And then I started writing vocals. And my vocals, they said, sounded a lot like Ricky Nelson. And there weren't that many bands on the scene then. So there wasn't really that much competition. And then because my dad was a flight instructor, he got a job at a flight school up in the high desert area of California, Lancaster. And up there, I met Captain Beefheart, Don Van Vliet. He wasn't called Beefheart yet. And Frank Zappa, and they had a little band called the Omens. So I started a band called Merle and the Exiles, and that would have been, oh, about the beginning of 1963 or thereabouts. And then you know what happened. The Beatles came along.
Oh, those wonderful lads from Liverpool. Listen, Merle, if we can take another mini musical break now, as I say, with Tessa and Shaley and Graham, because you mentioned Merle and the Exiles. Now, one of the most sought-after 1960s psychedelic recordings is, of course, the album Fapadocly. Did I get the pronunciation right there? Is it Fapadocly?
Yeah.
Fapadocly. Fapadocly. From Fapadocly, we've got Tomorrow's Girl. 2 minutes, 25 seconds of sheer bliss and wonderment. Are you ready for this one, Graham?
I am.
Your feet tapping, Graham.
Yeah, yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Awesome. A round of applause for Fapadocly. You see,
that's Woodstock again.
Definitely.
Even Merle in the 21st century, we still appreciate good music.
No, absolutely right.
You are still there, Morrow, I take it, yes?
Yes, good. That song, you know, was from 1967. Most of the Merle and the Exiles and Fapper Dockley stuff was recorded either in the Little Glen Record Studio in the high desert, or we'd venture down to Los Angeles and record in the famous Gold Star Studio. And they just put that album together of tracks that were recorded from 63 to 67. And Tomorrow's Girl ended up getting played on Dick Clark's American Bandstand. And that's when things really took off for us. And then jump forward to 2011, it was in the Warner Rhino box set, Where the Action Is, L.A. Nuggets, 1965 to 1968. And lo and behold, it was nominated for a Grammy. We didn't win the Grammy because they found some Beatle outtakes, and the Beatles won, but that pushed the album back into the limelight again. I'm just amazed, Alex and Graham, how this album from way back in 67, songs keep coming out in the future from it, and now Lila is in the Chappaquiddick movie that will be coming out soon, and Supermarket, a song on the last song on Fapper Dockley, ended up in Thomas Pynchon's novel Inherent Vice. So that's three songs that, you know, over many years came back into the limelight. And the album now, if you can find a sealed one, they're worth $1,000 a copy.
And a bargain.
We're all going out to look.
Yeah, so we're all going to go look for that. I'd quite like to make a cheeky K.
I know people that have found them in garage sales.
Can we find them and then seal them up?
It's a way forward. Tessa, as our sound and country vision expert, of course, any questions you'd like to put to Merle?
Yes, well, it's... You've obviously, after moving to California in your teens, you started playing guitar and everything. In your younger years, what kind of music did you listen to? Was you inspired by anyone else? I mean, Kentucky, there must have been, like, the country music scene over there.
Where's the country, Merle? Where did
your inspiration come from?
Well, my dad played guitar, and my mom sang in big bands. And when I was little, growing up in Kentucky, I used to go across the railroad tracks to where the black folks lived and sit around and listen to them play Bottleneck Blues. And that stuck in my head. And my dad, on my 11th birthday, got me a ukulele, taught me to play that. And then later on, when we moved out to California, I got an acoustic guitar. And there was something about that old blues music, the Delta blues and the stuff from the South, that stuck in my head because I ended up playing slide guitar also. So it was just, I had no problem writing songs. It's like songs would just come to me and I would have to either record them on a little tape recorder I had, a little reel to reel, or write them down real quick, because if you didn't get it right away, in a few minutes, something else would happen and you'd forget the song entirely. And I met John Lennon once at Harry Nilsson's house, because Harry and I used to write for a publishing company, and he invited me over during what they called the Lost Weekend. And I got to talk about songwriting, and John said, isn't songwriting a weird thing? Somebody will say something, and that'll give you a title, and you've got to get it down before it goes away. And I went, yeah, that's the same thing that happens to me. And he said his best songs were written in 15 minutes.
Exactly.
Mine also. And he called it automatic writing.
Imagine that. It's a number 9 dream for mind games, but still, never mind.
Yeah, definitely.
Graham, I feel it's time we had another little British connection with another bit of musical magic, if that's okay. And interesting enough, if you have one of those virtual assistants that vocalises, like Siri or indeed Alexa and so on, you actually get choosing tunes by Peter No One. No, it's not Peter No One, it's Peter Noon. It's okay, it's just, it shows that the computers haven't quite taken over as yet. Peter No One, no, but Peter Noon, yes. And Meryl, with your permission, we're just
Peter
about to...
Peter Noon is on one of my songs, you know.
Well,
he's on Calling from a Star.
He's got the power. That's what we're going to play now.
Oh.
Calling from a Star, did it float your boat?
Oh, 100%. All these songs have been incredible. They've got, like, real character to them, and sort of you can just chill out and cook and listen to them. And
Graham Harper, would you consider using some of Meryl's fantastic music in any motion pictures or things you were involved with?
Oh, yeah, very much so. What's interesting is that when you first hear it, if you come from that period, you recognise the time and the period and the style of music. And then there's been a long period where it probably hasn't been so fashionable. And now that really stands out. That was a fabulous piece of music.
I agree.
From 1978, and I was living on the island of Maui. Then I moved to Maui in 1973 with my group Moo. And we went up to the top of the crater one evening to watch the sunset, and this blue pulsating light just came over the top of the crater and lit up the floor. And we sat there and watched it with a bunch of tourists for about 5 minutes, and it broke off into two other pieces and formed a tetrahedron, an inverted pyramid, and it was pulsating, and then it all went back together again and shot straight up and disappeared. And I went down to the house, and within 5 minutes, the song was finished.
And that's what you call being inspired by the muse. We're listening in the background to Signals from Malibu. There's so much we could actually talk about and still need to, obviously. There's Route 66 TV Live, a show that you hosted for in California from 1995 to 1997. Holy hoop of other goodies. Graham, any final thoughts you'd like to share with Merrill Fankhauser?
Well, just keep playing that music and let's hear more of it. It's really, really nice to hear. Really nice songs, good, solid songs that really mean something.
Merrill, it's been fantastic connecting with you on the show. Have you enjoyed your debut on the Midweek Drive?
Yes, it's been wonderful. Have me back again. And you know, I'm on the UK label Gonzo Multimedia, and they just put out this Signals from Malibu instrumental album.
Is that able to be downloaded or anything?
Yes, I think so. If you go to gonzomultimedia.com, you can either get it digitally or you can buy the CD.
Nice. You heard it here first, guys.
And you've already answered the second question, Merrill, that you're kind enough to join us again in 2018. A round of applause for Merrill. Thank you, please. And we leave you with Signals from Malibu. Coming up next, hopefully, actress Sarah Huntley. Signals from Malibu. It's like directing Doctor Who all over again, isn't it, Graham?
Oh, I'm completely gone.
Exactly. You're gone. Tessa, that Leanne's not, has actually gone. No, she's coming back. She's gone to locate her mother. She's somewhere in Lincoln. I don't know. It's Leanne. Lord knows. So Shaylee's still with us. And we can say, not via Skype, but after all, Graham, it took us a good 25 minutes for Ryan Jones to work his magic to get you connected via Skype, so heaven only knows how that would translate with respect to Sarah Huntley. Welcome, Sarah Huntley, to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've just returned from seeing Paddington Bear 2 second time.
Just because it's called Paddington Bear 2, you don't have to see it twice, you know, on the basis of that.
So, I realised that as I said it. No, I went because I wanted to, actually.
I see. So did you choose Paddington Bear as opposed to The Last Jedi? Or was it just a matter of that's where I'm going? I've got my mum.
I know that you'd have chosen The Last Jedi, but I must say, for me, there was no competition. I had to go and see Paddington again.
You've got your marmalade sandwiches. You've got your, if found, return to somewhere in Wimbledon. You've got everything else on that sort of basis, really. So
absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's spool back again for Shaylee's benefit, because back in the 1980s, when Graham was cutting his directorial teeth, one of the things he actually did was a programme for the BBC, in which one of the things was Dave Lee Travis, erstwhile programmer who did various Radio 1 disc jockey things, he used to host a show in which new up-and-coming directors were given the chance to make popular music videos about popular music tunes.
Interesting.
And if memory serves, that's how you first encountered Sarah Huntley, Graham. Is that correct?
Yes. Hi, Sarah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Hello, Graham.
Nothing untoward happened. You know, don't worry.
The program that David Travis did was in the 60s, during like Top of the Pop times of the early 60s. Mm. there were no pop videos.
No.
You've got bands on and blah. But sometimes when bands couldn't come on, they used to go out and shoot flowers or two lovers.
Or they get Pan's people to dance, or Legs and Co would dance, and so on and so forth, basically.
Absolutely. So in the 80s, this particular producer decided it would be nice to have some pop videos from those great songs of the 60s. So you're given a choice of so many songs, and you could pick one of the songs and create a movie to go with it for 2.5 minutes. And that's what we did. And Sarah, really kindly, because it was probably a very weird piece to do, came and played a role in one of these videos.
I played a sort of woman child.
A woman child. Sorry, Sarah. I'm not sure where we're going in terms of political correctness with that particular one, so maybe we'll just... let's move on to the time of... yeah, Rosie the Anaesthetist.
We had a hilarious time, actually, because we filmed it on the steam railway down near Buckland. I'm trying to think where it was now. Minehead,
yeah.
Yes. And the people that ran that particular branch line were wonderful, but really intense about their steam engines.
Now, Sarah, when you say they were really intense about their steam engines, were they considering marrying them? Was it a case of they had...
That's a whole other topic of conversation, really, serious. Isn't it?
No, it was an incredibly serious part of their life, believe me. Yeah. Mm.
Don't touch that button there! Get your hands off my coal shuttle!
And they had... I loved it. They had, you know, when you watch it, I'm showing my age now, but when I was a girl, I used to love watching the old black and white Centurion films. And at this Minehead steam railway, they had those little, I don't know what you call them, but when you watch the old Centurion films, the girls would be, I'm going to say something else though, you'll misconstrue. But I'm trying to think how to explain it now. One of, we're going up and down. On
I think
one
you
of
should
those,
say it. Say it.
I guess, well, I don't know what it's called, Graham. Help me here. What are those little shunts called that you have one person on one side and they go up and down with a lever?
Self-propelling kind of truck that you pump up and down with a handle and it takes you along the track.
Yes. I always thought that was incredibly fun and we all had a go at one and it was. But it sounds really ridiculous now I'm saying this to you all, but it was very exciting. There's a horrible silence. Somebody say something.
The song we've made, the film was Paranoid, was the tune we chose. And what we shot was really bizarre compared to Paranoid even.
And that's why we still like to refer to it, even in a day where presumably it's never going to see the light of a DVD release. Maybe someday. Or YouTube, perhaps.
Who knows, yeah.
Oh, it should be there. We've been joined in the studio by Leany Jane. Yay, Leany Jane!
I made it.
and, of course, the wondrous Annie Snart. Same person, but, you know, obviously, one's a performer. One is the mother of Tessa. It's just wondrous. Just in time for us to have another Christmas tune, Sarah and Graham.
Oh,
yes, and this is from Penny Evans, who actually would like to say that in quite capital letters, no to the Jersey government. No, Jersey government, please don't kill poor Gulliver the Seagull.
I'm with Penny on that one, yeah. Don't do it, guys.
I'm the same.
Yeah, do not kill the seagull. Anyway, written by Demelia Denton and Ulrich Kilstrom. This is Penny Evans with Christmas Night. Are you ready for us to press go on this one, Graham Harper?
Yes, go. Word up.
Getting to be a Christmas tradition, really, playing Penny Evans and Christmas Night, our Buxton correspondent, and more, of course. We might even have some more pirate stuff coming through next year. But Sarah Huntley, what did you make of Christmas Night?
Well, I thought it was lovely. I wasn't quite sure of the storyline, I have to confess. Mm-hmm. But I think we were meant to be taken on the journey that it's a different Christmas for different people, and perhaps that Christmas wasn't such a good one. Am I right there?
I have no idea whatsoever, actually. What Penny sends to me, I effectively take on trust. You know, I think that's fine.
It's a matter of perception, isn't it?
Exactly. You know, it's like preferred readings, as we say in English. You've got your close
reading.
You
have the answers there.
You've got your comparative. There are no answers.
Yeah, but he's just reading off a sheet, guys.
Is he really? Well,
all we try to do is formulate the right question.
I wish I'd Skyped now. I had to get my
own back. Many people have actually wished you would Skype, particularly when you've actually got Imogen and John setting up on a case. But still, never mind. Someday, Graham, you'll have to work through that whole process. Graham, what did you make of Penny's Christmas Night?
Well, although I find Kate Bush interesting and odd and very interesting to listen to, I thought this voice was much more positive and much. Yeah. It was exactly like Kate Bush sung to me, and her voice is Kate Bush style.
But more positive,
stunning.
More positive, yeah, exactly.
It's a stunning voice.
You were punching the air with. With
I completely Graham. Agree. That's exactly what I said, Graham. Yeah.
Tessa Snow.
Good. Oh, glad.
Yes, I quite liked it. I found it quite mysterious. It was quite,
Kate Bush is all about the mystery.
It's all very mysterious.
Coming up next part, Juliet Harland with Light a Candle. That's going to be very exciting. And Leany Jane?
Well, I actually loved that. I thought that was really refreshing, and I think it was just absolutely brilliant. And I've now donned a Kate Bush hairstyle. Oh.
You just want to see what she's done with the headphones and the
photos
hair.
Photos on all Facebook, Instagram.
Yeah,
it's
that's
fantastic.
It.
She's a professional. It's all right. It's all good. It's the important thing. Graham, it falls to you to ask those last two questions to Sarah Huntley. We didn't even get into Rosie the anaesthetist from Casualty. That's going to have to wait until 2018. But away you go, Graham, please.
Oh, Sarah, have you enjoyed your conversation with us?
I have, and I promise to Skype next time. Very, very much so. I had a great time. Good? Yes? Yes?
Nice.
And would you come back and join us next year if you're ever asked? You might be asked.
Ooh, that was asked as opposed to anything else.
Is it on the bit of paper? Am I down?
Sometimes people can't beep. That's all right. We just ask them again. Sorry.
I'd love to cut. Source of milk from Mr. Levchuk. Yes, I'll be back.
Thank you. That's what we'd like to hear. It's good enough for Schwarzenegger and it's good enough for Sarah. Cheers, John Lennon.
So this is Christmas. And what have you done? Another year over. And you won't just be gone. And so this is Christmas.
Happy Christmas War is over, John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band. Excellent. Graham, up next, the man behind the imprint on a multitude of diverse products from Halo, the world's most popular video game, Michael Jackson's Tux and White Glove, Rolling Stone, Surfer and Playboy magazines, O'Neill and Gotcha Surfwear, Levi 501 jeans, along with some of the world's most recognised corporate branding and product design for companies like Volkswagen, Suzuki, Honda, Hasbro, the biggest toy company in the world. It's the awesome Mike Salisbury. How are you, Mike?
Oh, thank you. That's nice.
Listen, nice doesn't even begin to start the sort of legendary impact that you've actually had. I feel in many ways, Mike, that without your impact in terms of design and impact and marketing campaigns for movies including Aliens, Jurassic Park, Romancing the Stone, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Moulin Rouge, basically the 20th century as we know it would have not existed in terms of cultural terms. So, I mean, Tessa and myself, I'll do the introductions, let's get ourselves sorted out. Online we have Ace Director Graham Harper. He's based in London, England.
Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Excellent. In Lincoln, England, we have Shaylee McKenzie.
Hi, Mike.
Very big fan of Levi jeans. I think.
I own a pair.
Own a pair of Levi jeans, exactly. Tessa Snart from Glinton, just outside Peterborough in England.
Nice to meet you, Mike.
And Annie
nice
Snart.
Nice to meet you all.
And Annie Snart as well. So that's great stuff there. So, Mike, Tessa and I looked at the video on your website, which is obviously mikesalisbury.net, about the Michael Jackson story and how you literally, with a bit of inspiration, got him up to the observatory and the James Dean sequence, obviously, that whole thing. Talk us through, for the benefit of our listeners, just talk us through how you actually sorted out that particular brand image and the single white glove.
Okay, I saw The Wiz with him and Diana Ross, and it was good, but I thought, he's holding it back. He's so much more energetic, I guess that's the fairest thing to say rather than better, but he was holding himself back not to, you know, get in front of the other people. And so I know his manager, who, when I was a creative director at United Artists Records, he was in charge of talent, sort of, and Freddie DeMann. So I drove over to Freddie's office on the Sunset Strip right before Beverly Hills, and I went in and I said, sat down. You know, he had the big wooden desk with a glass top and like 20-foot high ceilings and more. And it was really a typical big deal in L.A., right? And I said, look, he's going to be huge. He's going to be the biggest thing in the world, and I want to take care of getting him there with you. So he said, go ahead. So what I did is I went back. In the record business, if you do things for the movie business or a corporate client, you have to do a lot of stages and do a lot of work and present things literally almost done, sometimes in a rough form, but that's literally almost in the same form as it intended to appear. So I went. I have a lady who did work for me. She was a fashion illustrator. And I said, I want you to draw him. I'm going to make a presentation of him because I don't think anybody can visualize what I see without, like, almost literal drawing. So she drew me what I wanted was Michael Jackson in a tux, because I said, I want him to be introduced almost as like he's premiering at Vegas, Las Vegas, in a tux, and this guy that everybody thought of was a child in a child singing group. So I got the drawings done, and Michael in a tux and black tie, and I took him to present to Freddie DeMann, his manager. And it was this huge office. You walk in, drapes in the back over the windows, no sun was allowed inside. I sat down in a chair, and then he was at the top of his desk like a judge in a trial. And he said, I showed him to him. And I don't think I really sold. I just showed him what it was like to see his reaction. And he didn't have any reaction. And he said, oh, he didn't get it, you know. And so all of a sudden I hear a little squeaky voice in the back from behind these big drapes. I like it. And then Michael steps out and he looks at it and he sees the drawing. He said, fine. He said, let's do it. I just want to have white socks. So I said, okay. We got him an outfit. My wife found him in an outfit, a tuxedo that would fit in the Yves Saint Laurent women's store in Beverly Hills. So we got it. It fit him. And he said, I just want white socks. So I said, okay, what I want you to do is roll up the pant legs of this tuxedo like Gene Kelly did in American in Paris, so you can see your feet, and the white socks just actually emphasize your feet in the dancing. So he said, fine. So we get around to it, and he wanted to be shot at the observatory in Hollywood up in the hill, and because that's where that one critical scene in Rebel Without a Cause is where James Dean's fighting the bad guys with knives, switchblade knives. So we went up there, and it was just crowded. There was no place to go. And they have rangers, park rangers, to boot you out if you don't find a legit parking place and, you know, pay the price to park. So the only thing I could see doing, because to shoot him in front of the observatory, it's a large building, like most are, with a dome top for the telescope and stuff. And there was people wandering in the background. So I took him up the stairway to one of the towers. And then I put him up against that with the Hollywood Hills behind, and I shot it. And then, when he got there, he basically just brought the house along, rushed out. He was late. He had a Rolls that he got for his, I think his 21st birthday. It was all dented because he didn't really have, you know, driving skills. And he comes running out with the outfit on a hanger. And I said, well, you got to put this on. Where? He just ran into, went to the men's bathroom. It was locked. So he went to the lady, said, not a problem. Closed the door and came out. So after the shoot, I looked at the footage and it was just not good. It was just lifeless, you know, and I go, this isn't going to make a statement that we need. So I went to his house of his parents. It's in Sherman Oaks, a real typical California ranch home, you know, with the oak trees around it, at the bottom of the mountains on the other side of that mountain is Hollywood. So I walk in and this is just like Graceland. Everything's covered in plastic. You know, this is Graceland. So you walk in, the carpet runner is covered with plastic. The couch is covered with plastic. And the whole family, father, mother, brother, sister, are on the couch. Well, what I did is I didn't want to show them the shots. And so he took me to his place. He had a townhouse just down the road from them in Encino. And I went in, and it had a huge lobby, like a Vegas hotel. And in the lobby, he had all these pictures around the wall, and most of them were Marilyn Monroe. Yeah. So we go in, we sit down, I show him, I said, these aren't going to work, you know, there's nothing here. So I said, we got to do a reshoot. So he said, okay, no problem. And he said, you know, again, I just want to wear the white socks. I said, fine, what you're going to do is roll them up. Again, I mentioned that to him, like Gene Kelly, so we know and we see your feet. So we went, I went to a photo studio across from CBS, Television City in Hollywood, and it was just in a little old-time strip mall, and the studio was on the end, and it was all open inside. I took it in there, said, we'll shoot here with control, and I had a photographer start doing it, and it was just lifeless. Just, he didn't know, he didn't know how to pose. Kind of, there wasn't really a way to direct him. And so, in a panic, I run out behind the studio, and there's an alley, and I walk down the alley on the right, was the rear of this building, that's old carpeting, an old, probably 30s, early 40s building with a rounded corner on the side, rounded glass in that side. And in the back, the building was all painted some green color and like military green. And then the back was brick. And then there was a loading dock. I said, this looks like a Broadway stage at rear entrance. So I put him up on there and then up against the bricks. And then nothing was happening. I said, do me a favor, put your hands in your pockets, your thumbs in your pockets, pull the pants up so we can accentuate the white sock. So he did. So I got the shot. And I just wanted to enhance it a little bit more. So I had a glow airbrushed over the socks. Well, it was all fine. Everybody loved it. But when it was printed, record business, when things are printed, they're printed for the lowest common money denominator because they run everything at once. And there's pennies or billed per cover, really. So his cover, which is this black kid, was run with a bunch of other white artists, and they find a setting for skin tones, you know, with one of those little meters, and basically they printed disfavoring the white people. So he got pretty dark in that, and I tried to fix it in retouching, and when I put the glow on the socks. Well, the separation was so bad. And I had this happen on another couple of things, like the Buddy Holly story movie. Anyhow, there was it created a line around the soft airbrush paint and then sort of the semi-glossy photo print. So you have, when they printed it, I went to see it printed, and it was just horrible. They didn't take any consideration for him. So I don't know what I was going to do. So I took a proof of the cover. I had shown him the photograph and a print, showed him everything with the retouching on it. And then when I went to show him the finished product, I didn't say a word they didn't want to unsell it or sell it.
Mike, it's just awesome. I can just hold it there momentarily because we've been looking at, again, your video, just looking at the awesome range of stars and folk that you've worked with. Annie, from yourself, any initial questions you've actually got for Mike?
Yeah, so I'm obviously looking at the screen at all the things that you've done. I'd like to know what the your involvement with Romancing the Stone was. Romancing the Stone. What was your involvement there with Romancing the Stone? I just caught that quickly.
Michael Douglas, Kathleen Turner, classic movie from the 1980s.
Yes. What was your connection there?
Oh, I just created the whole thing.
Oh my goodness! It's only my
just like that casually.
It's my favorite film of all time.
It wasn't all. What I wanted to do was make this thing more like a typical Tarzan jungle movie.
Yeah.
Piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
So I had them swinging through the forest, and then, and him holding the rope with her holding on,
yeah.
And the crocodile below them. And I said, "This looks like the cover." So he came in. Michael Douglas was a great guy. We're in the studio's marketing offices, and so he came in. And it was cold. And he had an overcoat on, and everybody said, "Hi, how are you doing?" He said, "Fine, what's going on?" I said, "Do you need anything?" He says, "Yeah, nosh." And I said, "Well, what do you want?" He said, "I want corned beef on rye and Heineken." And then he had that, and they showed him the art, and they said, "Yeah, fine," because it was all illustrated. And but to see the people who have jobs in the movie business, they've got to find a way to contribute somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, he left, and they said they wanted me to do more on it. The likenesses were great. They were not a problem. So I said, okay. So I went, got the art back to the illustrator, who was in Santa Monica, right on the beach. And when everybody came over to see it, and bringing Michael Douglas, and I had modified it a little bit, and everybody looked at it, Michael Douglas, "Yeah, I never had a problem with the first one." So that was
it. It just, I mean, again, the awesomeness is there. There's a whole series just begging to it. Graham, any thoughts from yourself?
It just sounds like you don't have as much freedom as you would really like any time.
Oh, no.
Your ideas, I mean.
No, I mean, basically you have to figure out where they're at, what they want, what will work for them, and then how to take it to a real professionally executed, you know, final step. But, yeah, they're... There are a lot of people involved, but it's never impossible to find a group.
I love the line you came out with, Mike, on one of the pieces where basically you fought the forces of communism with sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and we're going to come back to that before tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Day. Wonderful stuff. So many images there. Mike,
we're speechless, quite literally speechless by all your accomplishments.
It's an awesome scenario, but Mike, have you had an interesting debut? Have you had an enjoyable debut on the Midweek Drive? Has it been okay for you? Good self.
Now, what debut? Where? I'm sorry.
Tonight on the show, have you enjoyed it? Has it been okay for you, even though it's in the morning in California?
Oh yeah, it's not a problem. It's not a problem.
So, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future in 2018?
Yeah.
A round of applause for Mike Sanfrey.
Brilliant.
And the only thing we can actually do is go to another pop artist. In fact, it's Leni J.
They called it puppy love. Oh, I'll guess they'll never know how a young heart really feels and why I love him so. And they called
Expect no less, basically, from Leanie Jane. Well done. Marvellous stuff there. Donny Osmond, eat your heart out, but perhaps not literally. Graham, what did you make of Leanie's little incarnation there, her offering?
I thought that was really nice. I was struggling to wonder whether it was... God, what do you mean, struggling to wonder? I'll start again.
It's the memory of the last century.
Donny Osmond himself.
I know.
When he was very young.
Have you ever seen the two of them in the same room? It's quite amazing. Yeah. Almost as amazing as the outstanding Juliet Howland, who joins us now. How are you, Juliet?
I'm very well, thank you very much.
Good. Well, we thank William Coles, of course, who will be probably more or less at the end of seeing his children perform on stage in Edinburgh now. So, in case you're wondering. It's nice to see that. Yeah, exactly. It's great stuff. I mean, I don't know why he couldn't take the call in the middle of the production, personally. I mean,
it's a freezing of the show.
Well, exactly. So, but Juliet, an awesome single is what we're about to listen to. We've had we've had Christmas Night early in the production. We had clearly our earlier winner from last week. This is one which grows on one, I feel. I mean, Tessa, you saw the video earlier today. Your thoughts?
Yes, I did. I think the meaning behind it, I think it's brilliant, especially at Christmas time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, once it kicks in as well, it's lovely then.
Internationally wonderful. It all connects in just so many wondrous ways.
Thank you.
Was it designed to sort of be released for the Christmas season, this particular number, or was it something you thought?
It was. I'd recorded, I'd done an album and an EP, and then... I just thought, hang on, how about a nice Christmas song? And I love choirs and I love the bagpipes. And I just sat down at the piano one evening and it sort of just popped out of my head and I sort of tweaked it and changed it. And
As we've just heard from Merle Fankhauser, of course, it just pops into the head and that is like John Lennon. You just write it and you can't, if you don't capture it then, it's gone. The muse is gone completely.
Always have pens and paper and envelopes and everything lying around. Exactly. Never throw them away because you need them. So scribble notes. Yes, I do have all sorts of things scribbled, scribble notes on. So I suppose I just sort of wrote it, and because I'd recorded in LA, obviously your last caller was calling from one of my favourite places. I'd done the album there, and with this amazing producer, Rob Seals, and mastered by an incredible chap called Gavin Lurson, who actually his first album, when I was doing my album, he'd won the Grammy for Raising Sand with the Robert Plant, Alison Krauss. And so it's just pure fluke. It's almost like everything aligned and synchronicities have played its part that I end up working with these incredible people. So when I sort of wrote this song, I thought, you know, Rob is the only person I wanted to work with. And so I said, Rob, I'm coming out and we're going to sort of, you know, put the song together. And so he got the choir and... got a lovely guy who lives over in LA, but a Scottish chap, John Ireland, played the bagpipes. And what was actually really it's particularly special now and quite moving, really, well, extremely moving, is that my dad, who died in July from the evil cancer, is actually singing on it as well. I recorded his, because he was a singer. I got my music from him. He always played the piano and sang, and that was his big gift me, I suppose. And my sister's an oardsman, and he was an oardsman, so I think we both got different things from him. And so I stood in the sitting room at our old family home, and I recorded him, and which is quite amusing. And my amazing producer mixed his voice in with the choir.
Well,
so he's
Juliet, we've teased ahead. You've already mentioned the bagpipes, which is when the song takes on a whole. It transcends it for me from that point. It transcends. Annie and Shaylee and Graham and Tessa, are we ready to hear Juliet Howland with
Let's
Lighter
Candles?
Let's
do
this.
Do it.
Thank you.
Is that a yes from you, Graham?
I didn't hear you finish the sentence.
Are we ready to actually hear Lighter Candle with Juliet Howland?
Oh, yes, please.
Right now!
Yay. Thank you very much. It's funny, I don't sort of tend to sit and listen to my own music, so it's quite nice hearing it, actually.
Because it's an awesome tune, and you got a little dog in the video as well.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
It's quite emotional, really, because I don't want to be really morbid at all, but, I mean, in the video, the young boy in the video, in the photograph, is my brother, who died very suddenly at 24. And obviously now, and Dad was brilliant. He played an extra in it. He's the man sitting in the chair, obviously, what a stupid thing to say. Obviously, before he died, his ghost didn't
I don't
come.
Know. There's always a place for possible zombies if we really look that far.
Revisited. It's quite... I think it's a very... Yeah, it's quite a poignant song for me, I have to say, at this time. But, well, thank you very much indeed.
Hey, listen, it's generally our pleasure. Graham.
That's the first time I felt it's Christmas Thank you very much.
Oh, well, happy Christmas.
And to you too.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's what we wanted, to be, just to sort of have a, you know, the best. I mean, Rob is such an amazing producer, and I thought, no, I just want it to be not overly Christmassy. And I do remember, it was quite a funny thing, that I was, the recording studios in Burbank, in LA, and it's
We're looking at them now, actually, through the magic of that YouTube thing. We're seeing you actually perform in those Burbank studios, which the engineer seems to be wearing a Santa Claus hat.
Yes, that's exactly it, yes, because he had the hat on, just, and I was sort of sneakily behind, you know, filming with my camera. But the funny thing is, there was, I think I'd written a really, really, really Christmassy verse, and I went out when they were sort of setting up for something, and I went out to the pharmacy down the road to get some stuff. And like, I think, I mean, Barry Manilow is amazing, but there was a very Christmassy song, and I think it was Barry Manilow, and I just thought, oh gosh, no, the verse that I had was really, really overly Christmassy, and so I just thought, no, I don't think it fits in here, so we sort of cut it. So it's Christmassy, but it's not.
It's not too much. Yeah. You can listen to it in June as well without feeling as though you've kind of gone strange in the world.
Yes, it's got that touch of Christmas, and it's very Christmassy, and the video is obviously Christmassy.
Would have been nice to have seen some of the combined Scottish armed guards coming through with respect to their pipes.
Oh, do you know, I have to say, if I'd had the money and the ability, the dream is still one day to have, bagpipes. I mean, in the video,
it was good enough for Mull of Kintyre, let's face it. So
Edinburgh Castle too.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I've got lots of family. I'm quarter Scottish, so I've got lots of family up there. But I just thought, gosh, if that was the ideal, to have a video with the bagpipes coming towards en masse. But unfortunately, in the video, it's just me playing the piano.
But playing it very well with a nice smile, as indeed our studio producer, actually Ryan Jones, said. Plays the piano with a smile. It's very good.
Oh, thank you.
Very impressive. I see it again, because the other thing is, looking at some of the other videos, you've performed in Trafalgar Square and indeed in Winchester as a busker.
Yeah.
What can I say? I mean,
in Singapore as well, which was quite scary, because it was, that was 4 years ago, I think. I was asked to do a concert at the Esplanade or something. Singapore, so that was...
Well, if you can sing like, She Moved Through the Fair unaccompanied in Trafalgar Square,
that's it,
the world's your oyster.
Thank you. Yes, that was quite funny, because I'd never bussed before, and I thought, I'd done a bit in Winchester, but I thought, no, I've got to, it's like a bucket list thing, and I thought, no, I really want to go busking Trafalgar Square, but they've got very strict regulations about where you can stand and where you can't stand. I mean... you're in the sort of Westminster Council, the other side of the, literally the crack in the pavement, you're in Greater London.
Exactly. Takes you up to the Palace, the other one to the National Portrait Gallery. It's easily confused. You know, so often we've been talking to Richard Fitzwilliams, and it's just outrageous.
Exactly. And one side is legal, and one side is non-illegal.
Don't go there,
literally.
Don't go there, Juliet, please. You know.
Okay,
we always like to feel Siren Radio is this side of legal. Just. Over to Annie. Any thoughts on what you've heard, listened to?
I just thought that was just magical, actually. Aww. And it's just as if it was meant to be. It's a wonderful legacy, you know, from your father. I don't think that we can look upon it and, no, I don't think you're morbid at all. It's just wonderful that every time that is played, you know, your family has been part of that. And it's just...
But, you know, that means the world, because it, I listen to it and I can, you know, I know... I mean, it was very funny. So I've got some lovely photos of, you know, filming Dad and recording Dad in the sitting room. And knowing that he's in it. And actually, Rob, after Dad passed away, Rob wrote me my producer wrote me a lovely note saying, you know, and it's, he's there forever. And in the video, Charles is there. My brother is there forever. And it's just, I just wanted to make it really I mean, obviously, I didn't know that Dad was ill. Thank you very much.
It's lovely.
Thanks.
Tessa, would you like to read out Penny Evans' contribution to Light a Candle?
Yes, Penny has said, Light a Candle was beautiful and so uplifting, giving us all hope.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm going to cry.
Lord knows we need it.
Oh, God, we do.
Absolutely. In case you're wondering, Penny, what's happened to Phil Leonis? He's on tomorrow morning, midnight in Los Angeles. He'll be with us at 8 o'clock in the morning, so there we are. Besides, he realised that when you got the awesome Juliet Howlands to step into the final sort of slot of the show, go no further. Graham, you've been with us for the full 2 hours. Have you enjoyed your Skype connection?
Yes, very much. And Skype works, eh?
Yay! Well, let's be more precise about that. Ryan Jones works to ensure that Skype works.
He makes it all happen.
Exactly. It's marvellous stuff. And he's going to work again, because coming up after the news, maybe not the news, yes, in some way, shape or form, we will be having Tessa Snart Show, Sound and Country Vision.
Live
with Lady Jane, with a whole heap of other goodies from that point of view. But we also have to ask Juliet Howland. We haven't even had a chance to talk about your entrepreneurial business skills, which we will do in a matter of clear things from that point of view. But Juliet, have you enjoyed your debut on the production this evening?
I have indeed. I'm very touched, and I'm very grateful, and it's lovely to hear that song being played, and going out into the world.
Exactly. It was indeed wondrous. So I take it then that you'll be able to join us again in the not-too-distant future?
I'd love to. Thank you so much.
And we can talk about your entrepreneurial skills, which, as Tessa said, ideal for students.
Definitely.
Ideal for students.
Yes, absolutely.
So there's an invention that you can actually purchase online which helps things dry very easily.
Indeed. And there's another version coming out next year which you can hook over a door and you don't have to scream.
Lord above.
So
it's
perfect for students.
Where was these when I was moving to uni at first year?
V for Vendetta. There are so many sort of ways forward. Thanks to Anna Lewis, to Graham Harper, Owen Paul, Merrill Fankhauser, Sarah Huntley, Mike Salisbury, Juliet Howland, Leany Jane, Annie Snart, Shaylee McKenzie, and Tessa Snart, and you, dear listener, and what the hey, it's Christmas. Thanks to Penny Evans as well for keeping us updated from Buxton in terms of what life is like there. I think it still exists. Wonderful stuff there. Stay tuned. We've got Tessa and Sound and Country Vision and Leany Jane and other things happening with us in a matter of time. Can we all say Happy Christmas. No, happy holidays, happy Christmas. Happy Christmas and holiday holidays. Yeah. Let's coordinate a bit better, though. After three. One, two, three.
Happy Christmas and happy holidays.
I'd like to build the world a home and furnish it with love.